This is an ABC podcast.
This is AM. Good morning. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Commemorations will be held in Bali and Canberra today to mark 20 years since terrorists bombed two nightclubs in Bali, killing 202 people, including 88 Australians. Many survivors and victims' families are still struggling with lifelong loss and injury. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports, and a warning, there are some distressing details.
Husnul Hotima comes to Bali every year from her home in Java to pray at the site where she lost friends and where her own life was forever changed. She suffered burns to 70% of her body when the massive car bomb exploded metres from where she was buying rice at a roadside food stall. The rice seller had gone to help a broken-down motorist, but as he approached, a man got out of the van and onto a motorbike. Then the van exploded. They only found his sandals, says Husnul Hotima. The motorbike driver, they found his head on the roof of this building here. It was a bar then. They couldn't find his body. Husnul Hotima takes her long-sleeved garment off to show me the scars on her chest, her back and her arms and legs. The lasting problems I have are this foot, she says. There are still four pieces of shrapnel inside. There are more metal bits here too in my breast. They can't take them out, so I can't walk even a short distance. Australians too are in Bali today for the 20th anniversary commemoration. Danny Hanley lost two daughters, Renee and Simone, who was the last Australian to die.
She was number 88, and when I hear 88 Australians died, it brings a tear to my eye because Simone was number 88.
Time has brought some healing, he says, but he can't forgive those behind the attacks, including the bomb maker Umar Patek, who's set for early release on parole within weeks.
That's disgusting. We've helped out the Indonesian government with millions of dollars, you know, in support. And here they go and do this to us, you know.
2 decades after the bombing, Indonesia's counter-terrorism forces are still active. Densus 88, the elite force set up with funds from the US and Australia, has arrested almost 2,500 people on terrorism charges, 370 just last year alone. We've worked with Australia since 2002, its chief Martinus Hukom told media recently, including the ABC. Australia has supported us on multiple levels, technology and intelligence. We learned our intelligence system from them. For all the advances, though, terrorism remains a threat in Indonesia. Jamaah Islamiyah, the group behind the bombing, is not the same force it was, but terrorists aligned with the Islamic State group have carried out more recent attacks. And Sydney Jones, a terrorism expert who spent 2 decades in Indonesia, says there'll always be small independent cells committed to jihad.
JI is not interested in violence, but the pro-ISIS groups continue to see Bali as the place where they can hit Western targets.
This is Anne Barker in Bali reporting for AM.
Ukraine's president has asked for G7 to do more about the air defences for the country after Russia fired another barrage of missiles into his country. Volodymyr Zelensky says his Russian counterpart seems determined to escalate the war, and he says an aerial shield is Ukraine's number one priority. Europe correspondent Nick Doll reports.
As the sun comes up over Zaporizhia, a grim scene is yet again being revealed. There's twisted metal and broken glass everywhere following the Russian missile strike. It came down near an apartment block in the early hours of the morning, blowing the windows out. On the ground nearby, a shoe, a hat, and a pool of blood. A body is being loaded into a van. 75-year-old Helena Stepanenko is waiting on the footpath with her grandchildren. There were two explosions, then the third one, she says. It was loud. Things were flying everywhere. I rushed to the hallway. Children were crying. My grandchild was crying. For the second morning in a row, Russia sent a barrage of missiles into Ukraine cities. It says it's retaliation after the bridge linking Russia to Crimea was destroyed. Power infrastructure was targeted in the western city of Lviv, and smoke was seen on Kyiv's skyline too. Ukraine says it managed to shoot down 18 cruise missiles on Tuesday, but President Zelensky's told an emergency meeting of G7 leaders he needs more help and he needs it fast. The first point is defence support, an air shield for Ukraine, he says. When Ukraine receives a sufficient quantity of modern and effective air defence systems, the key element of Russia's terror, rocket strikes, will cease to work. The US has already sent air defence systems, and Ukraine's just received a German delivery of a truck-mounted system known as an Iris-T, and more are on the way. In a statement, the G7 leaders, who met virtually, said they'd provide military support to Ukraine for as long as it takes. NATO defence ministers are also meeting in Brussels this week to discuss ramping up weapons production. NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg says reliable arms supplies to the front line will prove the difference. In fact, he says they already are.
Ukraine has the momentum and continues to make significant gains, while Russia is increasingly resorting to horrific and indiscriminate attacks on civilians and critical infrastructure.
While it's hard to know what's going on in Vladimir Putin's head, Western spy agencies say he's increasingly desperate due to a lack of progress on the battlefield and growing disquiet at home. Speaking in London, the head of Britain's GCHQ agency, Jeremy Fleming, says Russia is running low on weapons and even lower on morale.
Russia's forces are exhausted. The use of prisoners as reinforcements and now the mobilisation of tens of thousands of inexperienced conscripts speaks of a really desperate situation.
The fear is that desperation could trigger an even bigger escalation through Russia's use of a tactical nuclear weapon. So Jeremy says his spies are watching for the potential signs of a looming attack, and so far they haven't seen them. This is Nick Doll in London reporting for AM.
The International Monetary Fund is warning that much of the world is on the brink of a recession due to inflation, war-driven energy and food crises, and sharply higher interest rates. Australia's economic growth is also slowing, and that's bad news for the Federal Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, as he manages expectations for his first budget in under 2 weeks. For more on this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, this is one of the gloomiest outlooks from the International Monetary Fund since the pandemic. What are the chances of avoiding a global recession?
Well, Sabra, first up, it's not great news for Australia. The IMF predicts our economy will grow by just 1.9% next year. That's a significant downgrade, with the jobless rate edging up to 3.7% as Treasurer Jim Chalmers continues to manage expectations. Global growth will slow to 2.7% next year. The IMF thinks the worst is yet to come for the United States, the European Union and China. And the storm clouds are increasingly ominous. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the cost of living crisis from surging inflation, gas prices increasing fourfold in Europe, the war pushing up food prices on global markets, and then there's the slowdown in China, not just COVID-related, but a weakening property sector there. The IMF says aggressive synchronised interest rate rises around the world to deal with persistent and broadening inflation means central banks now have their credibility on the line, battling inflation while acknowledging businesses and households are hurting badly. So some dangerous ingredients, and a decidedly gloomy IMF chief economist Pierre-Olivier Garinchaz warns a global recession looks likely.
2023 slowdown will be broad-based, with countries accounting for a third of the global economy expected to contract this year or next. The three largest economies, the United States, China, and the euro area, will continue to stall. In short, the worst is yet to come, and for many people, 2023 will feel like a recession.
Well, with that backdrop, Peter, how difficult will it be for the Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers to deliver his first budget in under a fortnight, when, in his words, there's a dangerous global economy?
Well, Sabra, Jim Chalmers will be in Washington attending the G20 and IMF meetings. He's also going to be sitting down with the US Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. He says the October budget needs to build resilience while balancing that with responsible cost of living relief. And budget repair, of course, means hard yards ahead, making sure that budget handouts are limited to ensure inflation isn't fueled, which would risk more interest rate rises from the Reserve Bank.
Peter Ryan. With the Weather Bureau warning of an increased cyclone risk, some communities will be facing it with little or no insurance. Not a single insurer yet has joined a reinsurance pool set up by the previous federal government to bring premiums down. And businesses and consumer advocates say it's left people exposed. John Daly reports.
In the Queensland tourist town of Airlie Beach, insurance that includes cyclone cover is out of financial reach for many. Restaurant owner Kevin Collins says his premiums have gone from $30,000 to $60,000 a year.
Our insurance premiums have gone up 100%, but I know there's body corporates, that there's buildings in the Whitsundays which cannot get insurance. And that's frightening for everybody involved.
The previous coalition government set up the Northern Australia Cyclone Reinsurance Pool to help. Backed by a $10 billion government guarantee, it's basically cheap insurance for insurance companies. And those savings are supposed to result in lower premiums for households and businesses. The pool officially launched on July 1st, but so far no insurance companies have joined. So Kevin Collins won't see any savings this cyclone season.
So many times these things are announced as to grab a headline, and the detail just doesn't quite match the rhetoric.
While relief from high premiums hasn't come yet, it'll be mandatory for big insurers to join the reinsurance pool from the end of next year. Smaller insurers will have to participate by the end of 2024. A spokesperson for Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones says the pool is operating on the previous government's legislated timeline. Townsville-based insurance consumer advocate Margaret Shaw says people have been left exposed.
And a lot of people could be up to 40% plus going into this cyclone season, either underinsured or not insured at all. I think it's a huge concern. You stand to lose everything.
The Bureau of Meteorology is warning of an above-average tropical cyclone season with a 70% chance of at least 11 cyclones. Julia Davis is the Senior Policy Officer at the Financial Rights Centre, a consumer advocacy group.
There will be people who don't have cover, who lose everything. And, yeah, it's really devastating.
Even when the pool is up and running, the federal government is warning the savings won't be as much as the previous government claimed. The Morrison government said premiums could halve, but new modelling predicts more modest savings of 19% for homeowners and 15% for strata properties. Julia Davis has her doubts about the effectiveness of the pool.
The competition regulator said the most targeted way to help people afford insurance is by giving them direct payments to help them pay for insurance. This reinsurance pool, like I said, it's a really blunt tool. It's just not targeted.
There'll be a federal parliamentary inquiry into the cyclone reinsurance pool in late November.
John Daly reporting there. As Australia's east coast prepares for more flooding, a plan to ensure more water flows through the country's largest river system appears unlikely to be met. National rural reporter Kath Sullivan has the story.
Yeah, it looks amazing. We've had some reasonable rainfall.
Menindee in western New South Wales is almost at the middle of the Murray-Darling Basin. 3 years ago, the Darling River had dried up. Now, resident Graham McCrabb says it's a different story.
The bird life that's here at the moment is just staggering. The ducks, the emus, kangaroos, etc. is just incredible. So, yeah, no, it's just a great place to be at the moment.
The keen fisherman has been following the progress of one of Australia's largest environmental reforms, the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
Oh, it's definitely can't be delivered on full and in time. I think that's well and truly out the windows.
The Basin Plan sets out how water should be shared between farmers, communities and the environment. Over the past decade, more than 2,100 gigalitres of water has been reallocated from farming to the rivers. Mostly, that's due to the Commonwealth buying water entitlements from irrigators. But more than 600 gigalitres must still be recovered from state-run water-saving projects. And an extra 450 gigalitres is to be found for the environment, both by June 2024. The Federal Water Minister is Tanya Plibersek.
We've got a big job ahead of us, particularly on delivering the 450 gigalitres of additional environmental water that was the condition for South Australia signing on to the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. The previous government delivered just 2 gigalitres out of those 450 gigalitres that were promised. So I've got a big job ahead of me.
In 2018, state and federal water ministers agreed that this 450 gigalitre parcel of water wouldn't be recovered if it had a negative impact on river communities. At a ministerial meeting today, South Australia's water minister, Susan Close, says she'll withdraw her state's support for that criteria and call on the Commonwealth to buy the water from farmers willing to sell, something that hasn't happened for nearly a decade.
This is not something that's a whim. This isn't something that South Australia dreamt up and feels like they'd quite like to have. This is absolutely necessary to have a sustainable Murray-Darling Basin.
At SA's Lake Albert, the last irrigator on the system, Sam Dodd, is doubtful the plan will be delivered on time.
No confidence at all that, you know, we now, although we're only in a relatively short period into acquiring the last 450 gigs, we've only managed to acquire 2 gigs thus far.
He hopes today's meeting will bring some certainty for communities throughout the basin.
Either an acknowledgement that the ability to acquire the 450 gigs is just not viable, or if it's going to be, how it's going to be done, and acknowledgement that it's going to be done at a significant cost to government and society and at a significant cost to irrigators.
South Australian dairy farmer Sam Dodd, ending that report by Kath Sullivan. Members of Australia's Iranian community will protest outside Iran's embassy in Canberra later today in support of demonstrators who've shaken that country's Islamic regime. Nearly 4 weeks ago, the death of 22-year-old woman Mahsa Amini in police custody sparked an explosion of unrest. Some Iranian women refugees and asylum seekers in Australia believe these events in Iran only reinforce why they had to leave. Social affairs correspondent Norman Hermont prepared this report.
As Azeh Nikfar listens to the song that has become an anthem for protesters in Iran, it's almost too much. The lyrics, "For women, for life, for freedom," resonate especially clearly for a woman who fled Iran 9 years ago.
I'm every day crying for the people in Iran because they need just freedom. They need human rights. Some of them disappear. Some of them, the family, they don't know where they are.
Azeh is seeking asylum in Australia. After her marriage ended in Iran, she says she faced harassment and constant discrimination because she's a woman. For her, Mahsa Amini's death after her arrest for improperly wearing a hijab represents a country in which women are not safe.
She has a hijab. Of course she has a scarf. I don't know why they kill her. She's a woman. She's beautiful.
Her days are now filled watching videos of protesters and riot police fighting for the streets in Iran. Adding her voice to the protest in Canberra, she says, is at least something.
Of course I feel it. I feel very bad, very sad. I can't do anything for them, just to protest in here.
Arazu also fled Iran, seeking freedom in Australia. She was in immigration detention for nearly 2 years and is now on a safe haven visa. The protests in Iran remind her of why she had to escape.
We didn't have much right and choice. As a human, we had the feeling we are just like an asset.
Mahsa Amini's arrest hits especially close to home for Arazu. When she worked as a university teacher, she too was arrested.
The morality police stopped me in the street and they told me you don't have a proper coverage of your body and your hair. They said, no, it's not loose enough, so it's too tight and your body, we can see your body shape.
Going to Canberra is her way of encouraging the protesters in Iran to keep going.
I think we never had such kind of things. Huge feminist revolution in a country like Iran, even male. They are fighting for their daughters, for their sisters, for their wives, right? And they are asking for that.
Demanding a change to Iran's ruling regime and threatening revolution.
Norman Hermont reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 20 years ago, Jamaat Islamiyah, or JI, launched its devastating bomb attacks on nightclubs in Bali, killing 202 people, including 88 Australians, and wounding hundreds more. Today, one of Southeast Asia's most respected security analysts on the lead-up to the attack and why a current lull in terrorist activity in Indonesia won't last. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.